I'm really pleased to be here today, and I appreciate the invitation from Aaron and the foundation to present to you. Thanks also for coming out at this very extremely busy time in our semester. I'll be sharing with you some work that's fairly new, and it pulls together strands of my research, a micro-level study that traces the construction of teacher and student identities in schools, some community-based work, and also critical examinations of urban school reform. And it's the basis of the final chapter of the book that Aaron mentioned. And so my goals today are to tell you a little bit about how schools have operated and who they've served in order to help us think about the purposes of public education in the U.S. In order to do that, I'm going to provide a little bit of demographic data to kind of present a cursory portrait about who participates in public schooling and what's at stake for public education in the U.S. Well, in my estimation, in some ways this is a bleak story because public schools are under attack, I think, in the U.S. context, particularly city schools, which some view as dispensable. But I hope to point to some promising courses of action that may lead to a shift in discourses about education and different policies and perhaps a new roadmap for how we might steer our country towards improving educational opportunities broadly. So, indulge me for a second. I'm going to take a quick detour because just a few weeks ago, Robert Putnam was at Swarthmore, and he's a professor of public policy at Harvard, and he's written about isolation in cities and through the U.S., inequality. He's also talked a little bit about the American quote-unquote dream. And in his presentation, he made some important points, I think, and that I'll build on today. He really talked about the public losing interest in education and no longer seeing it as a public good. He talked about the ways in which inequality is entrenched and that there's been this increased economic inequality that's perhaps been exponential in the past generation. And he really made us think about opportunities, right, as leading to success, right? Not innate intelligence that yields success, but kind of what opportunities we have in schools through our parents and extracurricular activities. But I think that there are some other things that we didn't get to hear about, and one of those things has to do with the ways in which the economy has really shifted dramatically, and there's this extreme accumulation of wealth at the very top. And he also talked about the fact that we haven't, in fact, solved the race problem, right, but perhaps there's a declining significance of race and an increased significance of class, right? These are things that people have written about, Julius Wilson over 1978, right? And there are some critiques about this idea as well. And I think, actually, rather than thinking about that, we really need to think about different social identities and how these intersections of identities kind of accumulate and position people differently based upon social structures. So I wanted to say that. As an educator, I'm interested in the last point about opportunities, not intelligence, or being our kind of road to success, right? And I also appreciate this move away from poor people making bad choices, which has been a popular kind of narrative in our country. But we need to kind of do more than that. We need to do more than say it's not about people making bad choices, but that there are other issues that need to be attended to. He, in fact, made the point that it's not children's fault. They're born to bad parents, and I think we need to trouble this idea. So this is a kind of illustration that Robert Reich provides for us in his recent book, Beyond Outrage, about just the economic shifts that we are currently seeing and what is going on with our economy. And I think it's a clever depiction because it shows the dramatic nature of these changes, but also how this affects social institutions, right, broadly, and schools as institutions in particular. So just a little background. So I said I want to talk a little bit about who's in public schools, right, who lives in cities. Of those people living in cities, right, who's attending those schools, district schools in cities, and what do some of the trends suggest to us? And I think it's important to note that while public schools might be under attack, it's still about 90% of the public who is using public schools, right? So what is that? What do we need to kind of look at to understand what's happening here? So this graph is provided by the National Center on Educational Statistics, and it shows a snapshot of student enrollment, first in 2001, then in 2011, and it has projections for 2023. So as you can see, white students' enrollment in public education is dropping. It remains fairly consistent for Black, Asian, Native Alaskan, and American Indians, and also students who identify as two or more races. But for Latino students, it's risen, 7% at least, and is projected to be 30% of the public school population in 2023. So I think that is kind of useful to note. So in thinking about some of the largest cities in the U.S., I've just taken the top 10 largest cities. This is data that's from 2000. I apologize for that, but it appears in the Seattle Times. Obviously, the U.S. population is concentrated in cities, right? And it becomes pretty striking to think about the fact that 3/4 of the U.S. population share about 3% of the land. Right? So we also want to think a little bit about as what counts as cities, right, and how that's defined, and I can share that in a minute. But in 2010, the 2010 census reports that 80.7% of the population lives around cities, and that represents about 12% growth in the past 10 years or so, from 2000 to 2010. So this highlights an important trend, particularly for public schools, I think. People are moving to cities, and this drives up a demand for better transportation, better housing, better healthcare, and obviously better public schools and other social services. But at the same moment, right, city budgets are decreasing, right? They're being slashed, they're cut, and also property tax values are also in decline. Just a note, though, I want to kind of think about who's in cities, right, and then who's in city schools. And if we were to look at Philadelphia, right, while there's 42.5% white residents in the city, they only make up 10.4% of district schools, and there's 43.2% Black residents. This is taken from 2006 data, and those residents make up 65% of the schools, while Asians are 4.5% and make up 17.9% of the Philadelphia school district, and Latino students are 8.5% living in the city and 4.5% of the school-going population. So I think it's just kind of important to note who's here and who is attending schools here. So this table breaks all of the presentation rules in terms of how much is on the slide, but I hope it allows you to see the national demographics as it relates to school types, right? So we were looking a moment ago at 10 of the largest cities, and then we can see in the top row there that those mirror in part the demographics I just shared for Philadelphia, and that although we have far lower percentages of Latino students in Philadelphia. So it's worth noting that like large, middle, and small cities make up the top section of this graph, right? They make up a larger percentage of people living in and around urban areas. And I made a note, too, of kind of what gets defined as urban, right? So in the census, this is any densely developed residential, commercial, and other non-residential area. So when we think about 80% of people living in urban areas, we have to kind of think about those definitions and if those work for us. So just getting to the thrust of my talk, what I want to do is consider some of the narratives of public education over the past and present. So in the mid-20th century, the U.S. had outpaced all other countries in terms of its access to universal schooling, and that's quoted Ravitch. But despite these array of educational options, particularly for families with resources, 9 out of 10 pupils are in public schools. So the U.S. has a narrative of this equal access or universal access and this idea of inclusivity and perhaps a notion that the hardest working, the most gifted can use education to change their futures, right, through American schooling. And, you know, there's some truth we might say to that, and there's some questions we also may have about that. But in many ways, I think, from its inception, there is also perhaps a narrative of an exclusion, right? So who was initially being educated, right? All but the wealthy were excluded Later, all but the wealthy and Protestant were excluded, right? All but the wealthy and women were excluded, right? So we can kind of need to take account of who was excluded, who was included, and when, and what this has to say about the institution of American education. Right, to sum up, in part, high-quality schools were available for wealthy, and lower-resource schools were intended for immigrants, for poor people, and people of color in the U.S. society. The other ways that educational opportunity differed, right, were not only through school type and who was included, but also through curricular offerings. So James Anderson is a historian of education, and he writes about this differentiation occurring through curricular offerings, right? In many ways, what was offered, whether it was industrial education for Black Americans or boarding schools that Native Americans were sent off to, right, these curricular differentiations reinforce the class, gender, and racial inequality that existed in society. So we're going to fast forward a little. I'm covering a lot of ground, but what I want to think about is the way in which the Supreme Court decision in the mid-1900s, which strikes down the Plessy versus Ferguson ruling that comes out in 1896, that schools can be separate but equal, right? So in 1954, the Brown versus Board decision sets a precedent that segregated schools are inherently unequal. And this is a time we see new strategies for segregation that arise, right? Whether it's through housing, whether it's through social codes, whether it's through exclusive school cultures, whether it's through move to suburbanization, right? People leaving cities and moving away. One effort to kind of stem the tide of people moving out of cities is magnet schools, right, which are intended to bring upper and middle class families back to city schools. And so these new mechanisms are kind of addressing the fact that now everyone is intended to be included. We know, obviously, that, well, we know that desegregation was slow to happen, if not stalled, right? And the Brown II ruling said in 1955 that we had to desegregate with all deliberate speed, which left many up to ponder what that could mean. And despite the resistance to desegregation in many municipalities, there was a trend in the mid to late 60s, all the way to the mid to late 80s, to move towards desegregation, right? And whether in the 1990s states and other municipalities thought we had actually accomplished desegregation, or whether there was a fear about the pace of desegregation, in the early 90s, many municipalities said that we could terminate district desegregation plans, right? And we no longer had to abide by that because schools were sufficiently desegregated. I want to argue that the U.S. schools have became desegregated by law and included a wider range of people from different socioeconomic backgrounds, racial and ethnic backgrounds, national backgrounds, there needed to be a new mechanism for stratification in these schools, right? There were some ways in which the mechanism that existed shortly after the Brown decision continued to be fairly successful in kind of maintaining the status quo. We can still see that in terms of housing patterns. We can still see that about in terms of school cultures, right? But because of some of the federal policies which come about in the 60s, the Voting Rights Act, the Kent decision, which had ruled that the freedom of choice plans were unconstitutional, I think that's worth saying, right? Freedom of choice, unconstitutional, particularly in this moment. So those decisions, those federal policy decisions, made it more difficult to exclude and prepare people differentially, right? So we needed new mechanisms, I think. So some of those things came about through the practices and policy. Well, I would say, so Belfield and Levin suggest that as we had more consistency, right, in terms of what was offered, in terms of policies, we needed a new way to differentiate in public schools, is what they argued, and what I'm also arguing. And that came about for us through some of these market-based models for reform. So charters allow choice and sadly have increased racial segregation. Vouchers allow families who are interested in private schools to use those vouchers to leave failing public schools. And also tuition tax credits do something similar to that for families who are below in a lower socioeconomic bracket, get a tax break for using those funds for private education. So these new educational policies and the discourse that kind of supports them, I think, brings the national attention to issues of school reform. And it provides a theory for why additional resources are needed within the systems, within the failing schools. And it provides a sense that these investments are being made. Despite the fact that there is attention, there is conversation, there might be more resources, there is an increased federal role, despite that, one might argue that this attention doesn't really yield policies that are making the improvements that we seek, right? That are creating more equity and more opportunity within these systems, right? So it's my fear, actually, that framing public education as failure allows the public to resign their efforts, right? And it distracts us from the ways that social and economic problems are plaguing the system, right? Are in our way at reform. I also worry that this framing reinforces the belief that we've invested the time, we've given it our all, right? These things are intractable. These conditions are intractable, and that we can't waste more resources and more time because failure is inevitable, right? In some ways, it reinforces the notion that the community, the individuals, or the students who attend public schools just can't make the strides. Urban public schools can't make the change and strides that we seek. So that's kind of, you know, a concern that I hold. So, I'm a little, sorry, give me 1 second. I'm borrowing Lippmann's definition of neoliberalism here, and it's she's suggesting that there are a set of policies, economic and social policies that form governance and discourses and ideologies, and they promote individual self-interest and an unrestricted flow of capital. So there's a way in which neoliberal strategies seem neutral, right? But they provide a language and a rationale for divestment in public education, while also preserving a sense that what's come to be known as core American values, values of freedom and democracy, are still at play, right? Democracy in this sense is represented by one's ability to choose what's best for them as individuals. And also our freedom is a freedom to consume, to pursue the best for us, right, that match our individual needs and interests. So this fundamentally changes the landscape of public education, and I think also of equal access to high-quality education for residents, right? I think it's really important to challenge these terms, to kind of look underneath them and to think about whether and if we have an authentic commitment to equity in education. There's a way in which these policies are aimed not only at, you know, not specifically at schools, but they're really aimed at reimagining cities, right? Positioning cities as global marketplaces, right? Perhaps asking us to change how we think about ourselves as individuals and how we think about our place in the world. Some might say, what's wrong with that, right? What's wrong with having the choice to find the best educational opportunity for me? And so I would just say that it moves us in a different direction, right? Rather than thinking about education as a basic right, we think of it as a consumer opportunity. And that it also moves us away from this idea that there's value in a cohesive democracy, right? Where people all have equal access to education. And perhaps it focuses our attention at interests of individuals. So the other thing is the idea of who benefits in that marketplace has been shown, right, that it's not necessarily those that are most vulnerable, not the schools, not the individuals, not the families that are most vulnerable, but it's actually companies, right, people in the private sector who have actually amassed a significant amount of well. So what this has looked like in the educational landscape is people like Pearson have, you know, and other test companies have created curriculum, have created assessments, have created, you know, reform plans and agendas, and there's a significant amount of resources that are going to this new marketplace, right, and not necessarily directly to districts and schools themselves. So I think it's really important to kind of see the discourse or see the policies and discourse and to shift the discourse around education. And I think it's really important who is speaking about education and who is speaking for education and who has the right to do so. Typically, at this moment, it's more often politicians and business folks who are talking about what needs to happen and what needs to change. But there are many people who have been engaged as activists and community members and organizers in an effort to speak for public education and to speak about education. The other piece is kind of how do we engage these issues, and Pedro Noguera talks about being in critical support for public education, right? One, it begins with the belief that we have a right to quality education, right, which is a little bit different from the current discourse, that we can talk about the failures or the challenges, right? We need to highlight those as we are demonstrating support, and we need real clear ways of evaluating the particular reforms that are in place, right? Is it making improvements? Is it yielding success? Who is seeing the benefits of those reforms? But I also think an awareness is an important step, because it's possible that how we hear the current narratives might be different, right? What we think about, how we hear them, how we engage in conversations. It's also important to consider the relationship between urban schools to suburban schools, right? These are not isolated systems, right? They're actually all a part of one larger system. And how does one policy or set of reforms in a context affect what is occurring in another context? I think another challenge is the dichotomy or the binary way in which we have the language we have to talk about these issues, right? There's a binary framing that says that if we kind of leave city schools, we either have to abandon them or we have to stay and suffer, right, in ways that compromise the health and well-being, perhaps, of our children, right? So those terms actually limit the kinds of conversations we can have about what's at stake and what can be done and what are the potential solutions to improvement. Urban schools, in particular, are serving mostly poor and minority students, and they're now viewed as a marketplace where business interests reign over teaching and learning and preparing future citizens. This is something that I think needs to be addressed. So in terms of discourse, I imagine that some ways engaging in those conversations, interrupting those discourses, presenting different frames will lead to different policies, right? Some might argue that there's a way in which federal policies have begun to shift. Some might say the advent of the Common Core is one indication of that where people have felt that No Child Left Behind has been a failure, and this Common Core curriculum gives us more opportunity to make sure that everybody has access to quality curriculum or high standards. But we might also think about the particular accountability systems that are in place. I think one of the challenges is that teaching and learning has become is not viewed as complex as it is, right, and that the needs of the stakeholders aren't really taken into account. I think another issue, right, is capacity, believing that students, families, teachers, school leaders have the capacity to make the changes that will improve the educational opportunities that exist there. And I think most of the policies at the current moment are framed from a deficit lens, which does not imagine that the stakeholders have any say, any solutions, or any ways to make productive changes. I think also many have talked about the importance of linking education with health, with job opportunities, and with other community efforts, right? It's not isolated. Part of the challenge is the lack of jobs, you know, poor health care, and kind of the ways in which the community is situated. So we need to think of all of these things as once. The other piece is kind of getting and retaining talented educators. In many ways, the policies of recent decades have led many talented educators, frankly, out of the classroom. That's not true across the board. There are still wonderfully talented educators, but the ways in which education is framed and the job has become deprofessionalized has had an effect on our teaching force. So if we move away from sanctions, right, and kind of harsh accountability structures, if we build partnerships, if we engage the government with teachers and community members, we might have more success at creating policies that are going to make improvements in the system. So organizing movements have designed campaigns that increase school funding, in order to create more equitable funding formulas. And I think we need to keep in mind that historically, communities have had success overturning harmful social policy. And sometimes the scope of disenfranchisement can be a catalyst for dynamic and thoughtful and effective coalition or collective action. So just going back to the question of capacity, I think if we don't believe that teachers, students, families, and communities have the capacity to shape and to lead the directions of school change, then we're not going to actually actualize success. For one, I believe that these individuals, these key stakeholders, do, and that the challenges that we've seen in recent years is directly attributable to the fact that these voices have been silenced, and that those with power and resources have attempted to leave them out of the equation in efforts that are presumably designed to improve the institutions that they inhabit. So I'll end there, and I think I've left plenty of time for questions and conversation.